live from Chicago. This is the First Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Art Sear from Carthage College, Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, and Khalil Mar from DePaul University. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Tonight, in our first hour, we will be talking about the events of September 11th from 10 years ago, and also spending a little time talking about the way that America has remembered the attack on the United States 10 years ago. And in the second hour, for those listening and watching or listening to us on radio, we will be playing a rebroadcast of the very first Beyond the Beltway program following the September 11th attacks. I was vacationing in Sweden at the time, could not get back to the United States, but was able, through the magic of radio and ISDN lines, we had guests in the studio in Chicago, including one guest who joins us tonight, Art Sear. And we conducted, this was several days after the attack, but again, it is the first Sunday night response to the attack. And I think looking back 10 years ago, you'll hear some interesting things, you'll hear some wisdom. Maybe not all the reaction was perhaps wise, but we'll let you make that decision tonight. That'll be in the second hour for those listening to the broadcast on radio this evening. I'd like to begin by talking a little bit about sort of what's happened today and the last several days in this country as America has taken this real serious look at what happened 10 years ago. And Charles Lipson, I'm interested and somewhat amused and a little startled, all three, with your reaction, because you felt that maybe there was an overdose of it?
I didn't feel like there was an overdose of it. I felt that by Sunday afternoon, having watched a lot of television on Friday and Saturday, and how emotional it all was, I felt like I had sort of reached as much as I could take. I'm not saying that TV overdid it, not at all. I thought that some of the things were very touching. And I thought that the line, which I didn't see delivered but read, where Bush, President George W. Bush, said, we know that evil is real, but we know that courage is also real. That struck the right note exactly.
Art Sear joins us tonight. He also joined us 10 years ago, so we'll hear more of you in the second hour as well. But your reaction to the media coverage and the way that America is remembering it, at least as depicted through the media?
I think it was mature and appropriate, as we've been, I think, since the terrible events of September 11th, 2001. I was particularly impressed by former President Clinton's remarks in Pennsylvania yesterday. He emphasized the importance of the right sort of warrior discipline and commitment to effective aggressive behavior. One does not necessarily associate Clinton with a warrior mentality, but I thought it was particularly appropriate. I also was impressed by the religious overtones and the importance of religion in these ceremonies. We live in a very secular country and a very secular time in many ways. President Bush, in office, a very religious man, did not normally talk about God and the importance of his religion and others. He did when he went to Israel. That's a big change for Americans. Franklin Roosevelt, also very religious, talked in religious terms during World War II. But I'm very heartened by the fact that religion has returned.
Khalid Marar also joins us. He's an associate professor of political science at DePaul University. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You are a Palestinian American. So your reaction to the media coverage of what you witnessed the last 72 hours?
You know, I was heartened. There's a lot of people that say that there's too much media coverage, but the truth is you can never have enough media coverage to remember, and I think this is a solemn occasion that we have to remember, not just as Americans, but as human beings. The atrocities of 9/11 were something that not only shocked the nation, but really brought us closer to evil, to what it means to be evil, to what it means to have, as President Bush called them, evildoers. And I think it's appropriate that we remember.
And I agree with Art that about the importance of religion. And I thought it was a real misstep by Bloomberg to not invite religious leaders to be part of the ceremony. It could have been an ecumenical healing moment, and I thought his exclusion was a mistake.
I also thought that it was very well done that we had three presidents all part of this participation, especially, I think, the visit of President Bush and President Obama, yesterday, and then the involvement of President Clinton as well. I think it showed to the world and as well as to the nation sort of a solidarity of foreign policy and resolve that I think the nation, strengthened, the nation. I also found it, just on a sort of on a personal note, and again, in the second hour, again, the broadcast will be what we did 10 years ago when I was in Sweden. As an American, I will tell you, I did not see a lot of the events of the last, yesterday and the day before. But I spent most of the day today in front of a television set, and I was crying. As an American, not being on American soil, I feel that a piece of a collective memory that everyone at this table has, and virtually everybody I know, I feel disconnected from that. I didn't have it. So when I was listening to the reading of the names today and the various interviews, although they were not necessarily emotional interviews, certainly were with the families, I felt more personally involved in what happened 10 years ago. And I feel that it's a piece of my sort of heart and soul that I missed. I had a different perspective, but it wasn't the collective experience that virtually everybody that I encounter every day have.
Go ahead.
If I could ask a question without being presumptuous, how did the Swedes react 10 years ago? It was a global event, but our relationship with them concerning war and the military has been strained.
I think that the thing that was most memorable is, and I was traveling with a very close friend, and that night, being in a small, I was on the Gotland, which was an island off an island in Sweden, probably the most peaceful, safe place in the world. And I heard the news on a car radio, just picking up the words terrorism, obviously spoken in Sweden. So it took a couple of, actually almost an hour to figure out what was going on. But that night, wherever we went, people came up and offered their condolences. Because we were Americans. And so it was a unique experience. It isn't the collective experience that, again, you experience with people that were back here in the United States who will tell you where you were. But it was unique in the fact that, the public memorials, the flowers in front of the American Embassy, which was right next door to Sweden Public Radio, where we did our broadcast that you will hear in the second hour tonight. But again, it was a memorable moment, but part of the television, to me, gave me a little closure on what happened.
Yeah. I've had
our telephone lines are open at 1-800-723-8229 if you'd like to comment on either the coverage and the way America has remembered what happened 10 years ago, and also we'll discuss the issues that led from that attack. From Seattle, Washington, to Walla Walla, Washington, and also to Columbia, South Carolina, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight on our remembrance broadcast about what happened 10 years ago. And I digressed a little bit from the discussion to share sort of a personal experience that I had that I felt a little disconnected, but I'm glad I was able to have a little cathartic moment on the broadcast. As we look at where we are in the world now, are we in a better place in the world, Khalid, than we were, Khalil, rather?
I wish we could say we are, but we're not. I mean, the truth is, our foreign policy has gotten much more aggressive. Regime change still remains the order of the day. We remain bogged down in Afghanistan and Iraq, And there's a lot of people that feel very negatively about our foreign policy, according to numerous polls. So I can't say that we're in a better place. I mean, what America stands for is not really what America is doing.
But if we're in a world where Gaddafi is no longer in charge, Saddam Hussein is gone, Bin Laden is dead, mm-hmm. and the Arab Spring is sending a signal that people in the streets are indigenously in the process of overthrowing repressive regimes like Mubarak and elsewhere. Aren't those positive things? And would any of those things happen without what we did and how we responded?
Well, I think these are positive developments that you mentioned indeed. I mean, there's a lot of bad guys that are gone, and we do have an Arab Spring. But at the same time, I'm not really too optimistic about what happens next. I mean, I'm very happy for the fact that these dictators have been overthrown. But I'm very worried at the same time about what will happen next. Like, what will people do? What kind of institutions will take the place of the former regime? And really, we have to help out in that process.
All right, what's your take on the 10 years and whether things are better or worse?
I think things net are a good deal better. Our commitment to international and multilateral institutions overall has been reconfirmed. Professor Lipson's book about reliable partners, I think, is a good guide to the positive ways in which international relations are evolving. And he didn't know I was going to mention that before the show.
The check is in the mail, Art. The check is in the mail.
I do think that we made a serious strategic mistake in our essentially unilateral invasion of Iraq. And I would differentiate that from other moves in American foreign policy. The fact that the Bush people recognize that is, I think, dramatically demonstrated by this president's second term.
Charles?
I think that there are pluses and minuses in terms of U.S. foreign policy. I think that the fact that the Obama administration has largely confirmed the policies of the Bush administration tell you that there are really important structural constraints on what America can do. And I think that the biggest change that occurred after 9/11 was the switch from a defensive law enforcement approach to dealing with terrorism to an aggressive take them out in advance if you can. For example, we know that Khalil Sheikh Mohammed was subject to he was already in our sights. We had him in I think it was 96 or something like that, but we couldn't pick him up because there was no way for the FBI to do it legally. Now they would have simply taken him in advance, and if that had happened, there's a real question as to whether 9/11 would have happened.
We could have had Bin Laden.
We could have. These are things that now would be handled quite differently. And the decimation of Al Qaeda is important. So I think the fact that they're going for soft targets, that it's individual people or small groups, tells you that that they've been degraded. But I would say that there's one big looming problem, and that is the increasing lethality of what terrorists can do.
Should we be celebrating the fact that there has not been a successful terrorist attack on the United States? Should we be thanking George Bush? Should we be thanking John Ashcroft? Should we be thanking the Patriot Act? Should we be thanking the good Lord for all of that? Should we just be lucky? How should we respond to that? The people are still out there. They're still plotting. If they could pull it off tonight, they did. In fact, as you know, much of the news today or the last 72 hours has been about reliable sources suggesting that there was going to be another attack today. Day's not over yet. So I'm saying is, hello, your reaction to that?
We have to be careful about attributing the policies after September 11th, saying that those policies are single-handedly responsible for not having a terrorist attack. I mean, the truth is that kind of reasoning is very dangerous because And from the right, it really sounds like, for example, the left arguing that the stimulus rescued the economy, that without the stimulus we could have had, a massive unemployment rate, which we actually do right now. I mean, the reason that we didn't have a terrorist attack is not necessarily only attributable to policies. It's also attributable to Al-Qaeda's capability and really Al-Qaeda's willingness
to attack. Who degraded their capabilities?
To attack.
Who degraded them?
But how to degrade them is a serious question that we should be asking, not necessarily whether we should degrade them.
But, I mean, I want to disagree with you, because I really do think, I think you can say that there's been blowback related to some of the policies, and some of the things that we've done have been counterproductive, but I don't think you can deny that the fact that we aggressively went after these networks has substantially degraded their capabilities. You can say, well, there were civil liberties issues involved, and in some cases the kill, not capture was a mistake and so forth. But it seems like the policies have been pretty effective.
The question we should be asking is at what cost? I mean, the truth is we could have degraded those capabilities through other means instead of, for example, attacking Iraq. Such as, for example, not being bogged down in Afghanistan as we are. I mean, in other words, we're basically engaging in a large-scale military occupation of these countries and really hitting a fly with a hammer. We shouldn't be engaged in those kinds of policies. What we should be engaged in is degrading their capabilities through covert operations, for example.
But should we, I mean, getting back to the core response, should we have gone after the countries where there is state-sponsored terrorism that was giving aid and comfort? Was that a good idea, Art?
I think invading Iraq was a bad idea. The Wall Street Journal in their weekend edition continues to argue editorially that Iraq was somehow involved in 9/11.
Afghanistan was correct, Iraq was wrong.
Yeah, in my view, I would commend to you the works of Richard Nixon, who in 1994, in his book Beyond Peace, argued that Iraq is very tempting. Saddam Hussein will drive you nuts and he'll take advantage of you, but in point of fact, if we throw him out, if we overturn the regime, we strengthen only our real enemy in the region, which is Iran. And that came true.
That Iraq was a mistake. And what was a mistake about Iraq in the end was that we didn't know what to do after we'd overthrown that regime. If we were going to go in, we had to have a policy to reestablish a state there, and we had no such policy. I should say, however, the two biggest state sponsors of terrorism, Iran and North Korea, we haven't gone after them. So there's been some
Does Iraq represent, however, one stop on the road to freedom for those living in that region? In other words, the people that are now rebelling as part of the Arab Spring now, were they encouraged by what they saw in Iraq? Were they encouraged by the pictures of the people holding up their purple fingers? By spreading, as George Bush said in his second inaugural, the spreading of freedom, lighting the torch, is that not even a little bit what we've seen as part of the
Arab Spring? It was a little bit, and we offset it by continuing to support dictators throughout the region and so forth. But the main problem was that we didn't really
we sort of backed away. I mean, you don't think we supported Mubarak at near
the
end?
We supported him until the going got tough, well, and then we walked away.
Well, yeah, we said he wasn't a bad guy, or the
right, Hillary right. Clinton, but I mean, in other words, I think that it's a kind of a mixed picture, and I think that the basic point is that if you're pottery barn rules, if you're going to break it and you end up paying for it, then you've got to have a plan to do something. And I think the statements that came out of the Bush administration, Rumsfeld, Cheney, and so forth, these are dead enders. This is all going to end. It'll all work out just fine. Those turned out to be incredibly overly optimistic.
Right.
And as Art just pointed out, Art Sear, the 800-pound gorilla in the region is Iran. And if you weaken the counterpoise to Iran, which is Iraq, then you have a real problem in the area. And I must say, I'm very worried about what the Obama administration, moving down to 3,000 people, they're going to snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory here.
I think this is a very dangerous approach. I mean, you don't fix the problem by invading more countries and overthrowing more regimes.
Who am I urging us to overthrow?
for example, this proposition that we would go into Iran or we would do anything.
I didn't make such an argument at all.
It lends itself to those that want to interfere or intervene in Iran.
It can lend itself to whoever it wants, but I'm not saying it.
But we have to be careful. I mean, we have to consider the role of the intellectuals and the role of the media on this, right? I mean, we have to be responsible. We have to be vanguards of what is right and what is wrong.
Oh, but we can say clearly what is right.
I think, if I can finish, I think that a policy of confrontation against Iran would be a disaster, a much bigger disaster than a policy of confrontation against Iraq. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't contain Iran. I'm not saying that they shouldn't denuclearize. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have sanctions.
So how should we get them to do that?
We should engage in policies that basically take into account the realities on the ground. And the reality is that Iran is engaging in a nuclear program for a variety of reasons. Now, we should give them a policy of incentives and punishments.
I don't
think that the answer is going in. Or if
I
that's
haven't
not,
urged it.
Or if that's not
it's
what
a
you're
straw
saying.
Man.
Or if that's
Strong
not what you're
man.
Saying, Charles, then the policy should be one of containment, not intervention, not outright intervention.
We have to pause. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. We're talking about September 11th. We're talking about the remembrance that perhaps virtually everybody, at least if they didn't watch it today, in the last 72 hours, and also looking back at the policies and some of the debates that have really sprung out of the attack on the United States 10 years ago. 1-800-723-8029. Live calls for the next half hour. Hope to hear from you. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Around the table this evening, we have Art Sear. Art Sear is the A.W. Clawson Professor at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin, born in Los Angeles, and a frequent guest on this program. And again, we will be hearing Art in the second hour when he was a guest 10 years ago, along with Gada Telhami from Lake Forest College, and they offered our instant response, or not so instant, but a couple of days later, to the attacks of September 11th. Charles Upson also joins us. He is with the University of Chicago, longtime professor, 30-plus years, the pride of Marx, Mississippi. Always nice to have you with us. And Khalil Marar also joins us. He is an assistant professor of political science at DePaul University in Chicago. He was born in Kuwait, and yes, he is a United States citizen.
Yes.
How long have you been a U.S. citizen?
I've been a U.S. citizen since 2002 now.
Why was it important for you to be a U.S. citizen?
I love this country. I mean, this is the only country that I can call home. And, you know, people say I'm Palestinian-American, but I'm American first and foremost. And really, like, when in a world where nobody else has taken me in, this is the only country that actually gave me a chance. And I feel like I've been quite successful, and I'm quite honored and humbled to be an American citizen.
One thing that I want to talk about what's happened over the last 10 years, how do and by the way, we should mention for people who are listening to this broadcast on the radio, we mentioned that Khalil is a Palestinian-American. So my question to you in the last 10 years, how have people who looked like you, how has their life changed, if at all, in reality?
Yeah.
10 years after the fact, because if it would have, you know, if you would have been 10 years younger, you probably would not easily get on a plane. Do you easily get on a plane now?
I do. I've never had any problems. And as a matter of fact, usually my travel companions who have blue eyes and, you know, like like European hair, generally have a tougher time getting on. Now, maybe that's my fault. I don't know. But I've never really had any problems. And as a matter of fact, every time I'm asked that question, Bruce, I reflect on the day of September 11th when we received more calls to my house, my home, my family home, of support, more calls of, we have your back. You're just as American as we are. More calls of, I hope nobody's messing with you, than anything else. We have zero. I can count on the number, you know, on my hands, the number of times that I've actually been confronted by somebody who was, you know, as the young people say, a hater. I've always felt at home here, and I've always felt that the American people are the best people on earth because of that.
I had a unique experience the last evening. I was going out for dinner. I live in the downtown area, and I was walking home from a restaurant, and I encountered something on the street. I part of me wanted to sort of ask what was up, but it was, frankly, it was probably none of my business. There was a young couple. The man was obviously American, or, you know, European of some kind. He was with a young girl, I would say approximately maybe 22, 23 years old, who was obviously from some other country, I would say Middle Eastern, most likely. She was sobbing on the street. People were passing by. And her father, also of Middle Eastern extraction, was pointing in her finger as she was sobbing. "You're not at fault. You're not at fault. You're not at fault." And her response was, "Wherever I've watched television for the last 3 days, they're blaming us. They're blaming us. They're blaming me. I can't take it anymore." And so I had an encounter between a father and a son in a busy intersection downtown because this young woman had felt that her interpretation of what she was watching on television had somehow put the blame on her because she looked, I'm assuming, Middle Eastern.
It's a very touching story. I'm actually one of those people. I didn't call you because I didn't know you until tonight. But I did our corner grocery, the one that we go to every day for a quarter milk and that sort of thing, is owned by people of Middle Eastern, not just descent, but they were all born there and so forth. And I went down immediately and told them exactly what you got on your phone calls, which is I'm one of your neighbors and I want you to know that if there's any problem or anything, you can count on me. I had actually helped them in one case where somebody had tried to steal something that wasn't politically related, but they said that numerous people came in and said the same thing. I think that the problem here, they've tried, President Bush, President Obama, and others have tried to make very clear we're not at war against Islam. The problem really is it's not just that the people who attacked us were Islamic. It's that they claim to be doing it in the name of their religion, and that makes the differentiation so difficult. You repeat it and you repeat it and you repeat it, but it's a very, they're not claiming to do it because they're Nazis, they're not claiming to do it because they're communists. These are secular forms. They're claiming to do it because they have a certain version of Islam.
You frequently share with us on this program questions and senses that questions you get from your students, and I know that you shared those stories 10 years ago. How have the students that you have taught in the last 10 years, how have they looked at September 11th? Because it was a defining moment in their lives when they were very, very young, and now obviously they're older. You may not run into the students, obviously, that you ran into 10 years ago, but you have gone through almost a whole generation
unless
now.
Unless they want to run into me.
That's right.
And they do. They keep in touch.
But how do they respond to what their life experience was?
On balance, it was an education that continues for young people. The younger generation always considers themselves to be wiser and more worldly than their forebears. As I may have mentioned a decade ago, what struck me, I was at work when the planes attacked, these college students who consider themselves so worldly and there was the panic, terror. They really were terrified and terrorized. As you went up the age scale, ending with people even older than I am who got us through, and we are fortunate to have some in our community who got us through the Depression and the Second World War, they really are the greatest generation. Their experience as well as maturity led them to be notably calm, but the terrible fear, it's still sends chills through me that our students experienced was quite striking and quite shocking. I think on balance, these war experiences mean that the current crop of students, to answer your question, they're a little more balanced about it.
I said that I have not been glued to the television for the last 3 days, although I was glued to the television today. What I was surprised at today is, with one exception, I only saw one video of the planes hitting the World Trade Center.
That's good. That shows maturity on the part of the media, because we've all seen it endlessly.
But
you know.
But I think I would. Why would you not want to? If this is a teaching moment, and you have a new generation of people, why should they not be reminded about what happened?
Because they can look at YouTube anytime, Bruce, excuse me, but that's an important point. And we all see it, including young people see it. It's been exploited a lot, especially by the commercial networks, not by you.
Do you see that as exploitation or just it's a part of history? I mean,
it's definitely a part of history, and we need to remember. Now, whether we need to remember the graphic details of 9/11 or not, that's up for debate. But I come down on the side where we need to remember the horror of 9/11 so that that horror could never be repeated again. Never again should be our motto.
That's what I'm – that's. I mean, I see the pictures of the first responders. I see them carrying dead bodies out. I don't think that America necessarily has to see – in fact, frankly, I have never seen the pictures or the video of people jumping out of the building. I've never seen it.
I have.
It may exist.
Did you see the falling man picture that was shown this several times over the past week?
No, I did not.
And it's a very touching picture. This is a picture shot against the background of both towers, and it's a man midway falling down, and he's head first.
Head first.
That is, he's dived out head first with his hands kind of
so
clenched
he's like
together.
A missile.
He's like a missile pointed at, and he's caught in mid-flight, and it is just heart-wrenching.
Should the video of the planes have been played more, or is that – I mean, we have a different opinions – you know, on the broadcast this evening.
I'm mixed about it. I see both sides of it. I think if you overdo it, it becomes a kind of pornography. But if you, but by
that's
the same,
that's what it was.
But
for some
if
days
you, by
after
the same that. Token,
but that was
10 years
ago. I would agree with you 10 years ago. But I mean, this is the collective memory of what happened. I mean, and we're seeing the victims, and the names are being read, which I thought was just. So touching.
I've been to both memorials. I haven't seen the finished memorial in New York, but I have seen the site. I've been to the site, and I've been to the one in the Pentagon, and right next to it is a small room for a multi-faith a chapel where you can kind of go in. And, of course, everybody that you meet there can tell you stories about their day there or people that they knew. I haven't been to the site in Pennsylvania. These are immensely moving, and I can tell everyone in the audience, if you have an opportunity to go to the site in New York, it looks like it's going to be touching in the same way that the Vietnam Memorial is so touching on the Mall in Washington.
Don't celebrate. They don't celebrate conflict.
They don't celebrate. They memorialize.
If I may say, Bruce, we may be overworking the point a bit. I've been in Wisconsin yesterday and today a lot for work responsibilities, but I've tried to watch television to get ready for tonight, and I've seen two or three episodes of the planes hitting both towers.
The only time I saw that video was on the introductory piece that was done by the local Fox station. It was for the Bears pregame show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The only video I saw was a Fox Sports presentation. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. You know, one of the things obviously a lot of people have talked about is the role of the first responders and the tremendous job that they did, and people coming in from all over the United States to help those, primarily in New York, but also in Washington, D.C. And I think that one of the other things that in the Shanksville experience, in fact, of the memorial services that I watched today, the one that hit me the hardest was Shanksville,
Pennsylvania.
And the way in which it was described as these were the first Americans who decided to fight back, and that they became the first victims of the response team.
Let's roll.
And Todd Beamer and what happened there. And by the way, that's now a memorial, as you all know. President Obama was there today. George Bush and Bill Clinton were there yesterday. And again, that memorial has not yet been finished. And this was these were people, again, they weren't necessarily the victims. They were on a plane, and they decided they had heard what had happened, and they were not going to sit back and not go down without a fight. And so they did that. And to me, they are the first part of the wave of heroes that this story leads to. And again, they are still looking for $10 million to complete that memorial. If you would like to contribute, let me give the website to you. It's www.honorflight93. We're going to keep this up. www.honorflight93.org. That will go directly to the finishing of the memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Again, United Flight 93, the one where people decided to fight back, and Let's Roll became almost the first a battle cry of this war against terrorism. And also, I think that when you think of all the numbers, and the numbers are devastating, over 3,000 obviously killed at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. But over 5 million, this came out during the speech today by the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, over 5 million Americans have stepped forward since September 11th to don a uniform and to serve their country. And of those, 6,200 have perished in the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq. So
we owe a very deep debt to them. Let me just say, as somebody who's walked the streets of Lower Manhattan, every time you pass a firehouse, there's a plaque in that firehouse, and there are name after name after name. A chill is going through me now as I say this. You just see, it just touched everyone. I was on this program, I think it was 2 weeks after, and I remember Diane Swonk was on the program, and she had actually been in one of the World Trade Center auxiliary buildings in a conference when it hit, and she was speaking to a group of young people, and she shepherded them out, and she was covered in dust, took off her shoes, and said she walked to Midtown covered. And when she got to Midtown, it was like a ghost town, but it wasn't like anything had happened there. She had just left a war zone, something like what had happened at Pearl Harbor. And now she was at Central Park, and it was alive.
Yeah, except Pearl Harbor, of course, were military targets and military personnel primarily.
It gets back to what we discussed earlier, and that is the importance, and you were making the point, Khalil, and that is, it is important to remember. It's important to remember the horror aspect of it. I mean, you're of a younger generation. There's a lot of people who are younger than you that, you know, that they may not have watched what happened on television the last 72 hours because they didn't have a point of reference for it, or they were too young.
Right, exactly. I mean, what's really disturbing, and that's really part of life, is that a lot of my students now say that they were in the sixth grade. And being in the sixth grade, they have a vivid memory of what took place on that day, but they really don't know exactly what it meant. They didn't know what the significance was for the United States of America, because just because they remember 9/11 does not mean they remember what preceded 9/11, right? And just because they don't remember, and because they don't remember what preceded 9/11, we have to emphasize the fact that this is not only sacred ground, it's ground zero, but this is also something where it's the first time that we've ever been attacked on our soil. I mean, this is something that most of us don't have memory of, and especially our young people who don't have a recollection of history need to be reminded of the significance of this day, not just the people that died, but also the fact that we were under attack that day for the first time in American history, not
since
the War of 1812.
And we thought another one was coming.
Kind of an attack. Yeah. Right, exactly.
We thought another one was coming.
And that's why I think when you put in context, especially the critics of the Bush administration and some of the very restrictive things that happened immediately, Art, is to put it in context. You didn't know. Even Dick Cheney in his book talks about, you really didn't know what was happening next. And also to put it in context, the anthrax scare that came, I mean, to me, the anthrax scare was more devastating. I was more worried about a continuation of an anthrax attack than I was about, you know, another plane going into a building.
But apparently it was not connected with international terrorism.
It was not. But
insofar as we know, the man took his life before he could be tried, but it was not connected with Al-Qaeda.
But for a while,
that was the great fear, and still is a great fear, that chemical and biological agents, we talk a lot about nuclear, including radioactive, even if it's a dirty bomb, but boy, they're still bad guys out there. They still want to attack us, and they'll use the most deadly things that they can. And the question is, how do you respond in advance to that without stomping all over our civil liberties? It's a very hard problem.
And that is the continuing debate that that will live on. And fortunately, we live in a country where we can continue to have that debate. Joining us tonight, Art Sear has been with us. He's the A.W. Clawson Professor at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Also joining us this evening is Charles Lipson, a political science professor from the University of Chicago and Marks, Mississippi. And Khalil Marar has also been with us. He is a visiting assistant professor at DePaul University, and he joins us, and we thank them all for being with us in our first hour of our broadcast this evening. If you are listening to this program coast to coast on radio, on America's great terrestrial radio stations, a reminder that after the news coming up at the top of the hour, you will hear the broadcast, the first broadcast of Beyond the Beltway following the attacks of September 11th, 10 years ago. Interesting broadcast. Stay tuned. Back shortly from Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont. We now present the Beyond the Beltway program from September 16, 2001, our first response to the attack on the World Trade Center and Pentagon.
Experts Art Sear and Gotta Tell Honey. Our program tonight coming to you from the studios of WLS Radio in Chicago and from Radio Sweden in Stockholm, where I have been stranded since the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon last week. Our phone lines, however, remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. Tonight on this program, we want as many phone calls as possible as we take America's political pulse and focus tonight our attention on the future, examining what actions the United States should take in response to the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. We are at war tonight, and this evening we will discuss the form of our national retaliation and American resolve to punish those who invaded our land, hijacked our skies, left a wake of human tragedy, and who will force us now to change the way we live our daily lives. America's military at this hour is readying for a response. 50,000 reservists will soon bolster our national security effort. Civilian vigilance must also be alert, as would-be terrorists still lurk in our midst. President Bush called the cowardly acts in New York and Washington the first war of the 21st century, and the war has already brought us our first heroes, the hundreds of New York City firefighters who are doing the ghastliest of jobs with the heaviest of hearts, saddened by the loss of several hundred fallen colleagues. Then there is the heroic action of businessman Todd Beamer, who led fellow passengers in storming the cockpit of one hijacked plane flying over Pennsylvania, forcing that plane to crash in an open field instead of heading to another target, perhaps the White House. At this hour, the eyes of the world are focused on Pakistan and Afghanistan, where suspected master terrorist Osama bin Laden is held up. Art Sear is back in our Chicago home studio. Professor Sear is with Carthage College, author of the book After the Cold War, Europe and Asia. Art, what must the United States do now to avenge those who have died, and must that action be swift?
It doesn't necessarily have to be swift. It has to be sure, and in fact, being measured is a good deal more important than doing the wrong thing and lashing out at this point still relatively blindly. I think it's crucial that the coalition be held together. I myself thought maybe the only allies who'd be with us on this were the British, and clearly I'm glad to say I was wrong in the heat of the moment. The second thing we have to do is anticipate the next terrorist move. This loosely organized coalition of terrorists has been extremely good at surprising us, not only this time, but in putting a hole in the USS Cole, a rather well-guarded U.S. destroyer warship, and killing over a dozen U.S. service people, killing almost 300 people, I believe, in the two embassy bombings in Africa, and earlier on in the tower bombing in Saudi Arabia, and Osama bin Laden at least takes credit for the killing of 18 American Rangers in Somalia. The next thing, thinking outside the box, the next thing, and the third point related to both of those is vast expansion of the number and expertise of the people involved in human intelligence, not technical intelligence, but human intelligence. Excuse me.
We are also joined by Gada Tilhami. She is a professor of political science at Lake Forest College, a frequent guest on this program. She is a Palestinian-American. She has been a citizen of the United States for over 30 years. And Gada, before we get to the specifics of your academic expertise, as a Palestinian, what was your reaction to the video of cheering Palestinians at news of the tragedy in New York and Washington?
I was disappointed, but I was also disappointed that I think the media made more of it than they need to. I think this was only in one town in the West Bank, and I think, in a way, we kind of expected something like this a little bit. These are people who are attacked by Israeli troops using American weapons daily. They are attacked by Apache helicopters, Phantom jets, and they certainly never saw anybody in the United States cry for their own children. So there was this unbelievable, kind of unexpected reaction. It is kind of, in a way, disappointing. But I think the media
You are very observant of propaganda and certainly know the power of the picture. The power of that picture can only mean more difficult times ahead for our involvement in the Middle East insofar as the Palestinians are concerned. Would you acknowledge that?
No, I don't think so. I think, on the contrary, the United States will have to re-examine its policy towards the Palestinians and towards the Arab-Israeli conflict. This is one picture of several. What is more important and more heartening is that Chairman Arafat had enough sense to actually condemn this act in clear terms. This was very important for all of us here, for all the Arab world. But I think this will not make the United States any more harsh towards the Palestinians than it has been. The United States has not been kind towards the Palestinians so far.
Art Sear, I mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast, the eyes of the world are focused on Pakistan and Afghanistan. Right now on Pakistan, the leaders there are delivering a message to Afghanistan that within 3 days they must turn over Osama bin Laden or else suffer the consequences.
Yes.
Does Pakistan have the most leverage on the Taliban that rule Afghanistan, or are there other forces and sources of pressure that could be applied on them at this time?
There are a variety of pressures that can be applied, but Pakistan is in a crucial position strategically. During the Cold War, they were an important ally of the United States, and while Islamic fundamentalism has gained ground among military officers, and the military is, of course, the dominant power in Pakistan, there is a lingering and very strong British tradition, not just among older military leaders, that makes, I think, indirectly at least, makes them sympathetic to the United States.
You don't expect the Afghans to accept this and to deliver bin Laden, do you?
The Taliban. There is a resistance movement, and an important one, the resistance movement that struck Kabul the night of after the bombings of the towers here in the morning. Mm-hmm. I would think not, given their history and given their but I don't know. Afghanistan is in terrible shape. The Taliban is an extremist, rigid movement, but they are under enormous economic pressure, especially if the Americans link economic assistance with the threat of military action. It just might work. I've been more pessimistic so far.
Gada, let me ask you a quick question about Pakistan. And again, forgive us, this transcontinental communication sometimes has us talking over each other, but I apologize for that. To you, Gada, insofar as Pakistan, if they support the United States, as they already are by doing what they're doing at the moment, what ramifications do they have domestically, and how could this, frankly, blow up in their face?
Well, they will face the possibility of domestic unrest because there is a current of support towards the Taliban. The Taliban originated in the theological schools in Pakistan. So we should expect that. Also bear in mind, the Pakistani regime is a military regime. It doesn't have much popular support to begin with. But you also must realize that I think what we are talking about, if we're talking only a military solution, is perhaps destabilizing the entire region.
We do have to pause. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. I'm Bruce Dumont from coast to coast and now around the world, live from Stockholm, Sweden. We'll be back with Beyond the Beltway shortly. From Spokane, Washington to Stockholm, Sweden, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. In case you just tuned in, I am in Stockholm, Sweden. Like many Americans, I am stranded in Europe. When I heard the news this past week, I was on an island off an island. If you know Sweden, I was off Gotland Island on Faroe Island. And was returning, waiting for the ferry, when flipped on the radio, and it was all Swedish. But I could pick out from that newscast, World Trade Center, terrorist attack, American Airlines, United Airlines, and then went through a most frustrating period of about 6 or 7 hours without any English-speaking radio or television, getting back to a hotel room that did not have CNN. And it was phone calls back to the United States with lines busy, not even being able to get back to the United States via phone to find out what was transpiring. So it was a most frustrating 7 or 8 hours that day. And since that time, when I have now moved back to Stockholm and in a hotel with access to CNN, there is some connectivity. But I must share with you that I've never had more of a sense of emptiness and separation from what is transpiring in the country that I love so much. So tonight, as I hear your calls from around the country, it's good to hear voices from back home, and also you will be bringing me up to date on things that I might not even know or may have missed in the gap that exists in my history of this event. Let us go to Youngstown, Ohio, where Dave is listening to us on WKBN. Good evening, Dave. You're on Beyond the Beltway, coast to coast.
Good evening. I'd just like to respond on 2 points. One is the second point of the gentleman that's a professor there.
Art Sear.
Yes. The first point, there, each county in the United States should have the sheriff department monitor the water supply in the area, because that probably will be their next attack. The second comment is about the lady there, the professor.
Gotta tell Hami.
Yes. That wasn't one incident. There has been incidences all over the United States where the Palestinians have been celebrating in the streets of our United States about this. So
I don't think that's true. I really would quarrel with that. I'm not aware of any news reports.
Well, Cleveland, there was a couple instances in Cleveland personally that I know of.
No way. The Palestinian community has been terrified and went out of its way to express outrage at this attack on our adopted country. This is our adopted country.
Oh, no, sure. I understand, but there has been incidences.
No way. No.
Dave, let me ask you the question, because one of the questions I mentioned at the beginning is what we as a country must be. We must be more vigilant. How should we be more vigilant, in your view?
Well, you know, I understand that Americans are from all backgrounds and all religions. I understand that, but I don't, you know, I just believe that if you don't like this country, then get out. You know what I mean?
Well, may I respond, Bruce?
Yes, you may, God.
I think this is a situation when we have to exercise vigilance as well as the protection of our civil rights, especially the civil rights of naturalized Americans. Because it's, if you really tamper with civil rights of Palestinians or Arabs or Muslims, then there's no protection for gays and lesbians, for other minorities, for anything that is out of the mainstream.
But, Gada, is there anything wrong at this particular time in our history if... you know, if those from the Arab world, because those authorities don't know whether they're naturalized citizens or they've snuck into the country, is there anything wrong for them to be profiled at a time like this when everyone is so edgy?
Actually, the airlines have been conducting all kinds of profiling, computer profiling, watching patterns of travel, who comes in and what countries they visit. So it's been done. Well, obviously, you have to profile and watch people who have immigrant visas or new visas or visitors' visas. But I think what the general public sometimes is saying, let's go after anybody who looks Middle Eastern. And that, I think, is not allowable and should not be tolerated.
Why should that not be tolerated at a time like this?
because this is, we've been talking for a long time about racial profiling. It is actually something that strips away your civil rights.
But who cares, frankly, about stripping away civil rights when people who look maybe like you do are blowing up planes and killing Americans? What's wrong at this point in history with looking, giving a second glance to those people?
Remember,
I don't think that's foolish.
Bruce, remember what Timothy McVeigh looked like. Timothy McVeigh looked like any average American.
But he did not do that, did he? He did not do what we're talking about.
He did the Oklahoma thing, which is second worst, maybe.
Bruce?
Okay.
Let us move to Tom. I'm going to take another call. Let's go to Tom in Seattle, then we'll go back to you, Art. Go ahead. Listening to us on KVI.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think your woman guest there, she's been here 30 years, did she say?
Yes.
Sounds like she's been here about 30 days, given the amount of prejudice and bias she has against the American cause and trying to link it up with Israel and make us seem like the bad guys and deserving of the terrorism that we were subjected to last Tuesday.
I don't think she said that, sir.
I got that from her tone of voice.
No.
I mean, I see a very, very harsh, judgmental tone of voice. There's no... There's no sense of compassion there. There's no forgiveness or anything else.
Well, I'm sitting here looking at her, and actually she's a very warm and positive person. Diversity,
sure,
remember, sir, is a source
like
of strength in this country.
Well,
Tom, what should we do?
Naturalized citizens do not enjoy the same protection as born citizens.
Oh?
And I really think anyone who's been here from the Middle East for less than 5 years should be immediately deported. And I say that because our country has been so crippled by the Clinton administration for the past 8 years in terms of counter-terrorist espionage, that I really think we're so far behind the curve that we need to go back and retrench and deport all those people. And then after the war, then we'll consider bringing some of them back in after they've been thoroughly screened.
Could I respond
to that?
What's
your reaction to that?
Well, actually, one of the things that I found most heartening, and it relates to the reaction of the average American, including the fireman and the rescue worker, after the attack on Pearl Harbor, and that's an obvious parallel with this one, there was a tremendous hysteria on the West Coast against Japanese Americans. We interned Japanese Americans, as you know, in one of the really dark chapters of our history. Politicians flew through gasoline on the fires of public outrage, including Earl Warren, Attorney General of California, who pushed for this. He wanted to be governor. FDR saw it was a bad idea. He didn't like being upstaged, but there was nothing he could do. We've seen nothing like that kind of unfolding of events, either on the part of the population at large or on the part of the politicians. Related to that, these Palestinian parties that were emphasized, I believe CNN broadcast that at most a couple of times and thought better of it. Fox, which I consider a very sensationalistic network, did not pick it up. Again, unlike the period after Pearl Harbor, I think the media has been extremely responsible. We are growing up as a country. They've been completely censored, sir.
Okay, let me.
The people in the street don't feel the way that the newspapers and the TV are reporting it.
They don't feel the way you. They don't feel the way you do.
Let me mention something, not the public at large.
I talked to a lot of people, and most people agree with me on this case.
Bruce, let me just mention something.
Go ahead to you, Tom. Thanks for your
My husband lost a cousin in the World Trade Center, a young currency trader with the same last name like ours, and he was a Palestinian American. There are Pakistani Muslims who lost their lives in the World Trade Center. So we're all Americans here. We're all in the trenches together, and we cannot ignore that.
Let's go to San Diego, where Chris is listening to us on KOGO. Chris, are you there?
Hello?
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Now, I've noticed that the media in general likes to call these, quote, modern Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, or even Kuwait. Now, I've been to the Middle East, and these so-called modern countries tend to have the most fanatical Muslims than even countries like Syria, Iraq, or Lebanon, but yet we seem to have this kind of friendly relationship. Should we question that? Maybe your Arab commentator can elaborate a little bit.
Well,
go ahead, Gada.
Whatever you do in the next 2 weeks, whether it be a military attack to take out bin Laden or to attack Afghanistan, you need an Arab alliance, whether we like it or not. The Middle East is not going to disappear, and we need that kind of alliance. There are different levels of modernization in the Middle East. There are fanatics and there are moderates. But we are here in order to work with all these people. Our government knows this. Remember the role of the Arab coalition during the Gulf War. I think it played a significant role.
I agree with you, but like in Saudi Arabia, I mean, their laws are very intolerant of other religions. I mean, Christians can't build a church in Saudi Arabia, but they can in Baghdad or they can in Damascus. Now, we should question that. I mean, if they're going to be intolerant of Christians, I mean, we should put pressure on them. And the same with Egypt or other so-called moderate. I think they're called moderate because they're friendly to the U.S., but they're really intolerant when it comes to other religions.
It's interesting that you mentioned that Christians are okay in Syria and in Iraq, but the United States doesn't have relationships with Iraq and is not very friendly to Syria. So where do we go from here? Do we intervene in every country's internal policies?
We move on. Thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Mark listening to us in Oak Forest on News Talk 89 WLS. Good evening.
Good evening. My question is, with every word that they speak, the Taliban leadership gets in more trouble. They isolate themselves more. And your thoughts about the hatred between Iran, the Taliban, Iraq, do we exploit the hatred that they have there?
Can you summarize that for us, Art?
I think the gentleman's quite right in the sense that each of the countries surrounding Afghanistan has to be concerned about varieties of Islamic fundamentalism, and each of them has an incentive to back, at least to some extent, an effort to take out this terrorist network, not just Osama bin Laden. Iran has been most interesting in terms of the expressions of sympathy as well as support for the U.S. cause. Quite remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, may I say something?
Yes, you may.
The Taliban actually should not be blamed on the Muslim world. They really have a lot of tribalism in their religion. They are abhorred by many Muslims. Let's remind the public right now that only three countries in the world maintain diplomatic relations with the Taliban regime. So it's a very unusual regime.
And Saudi Arabia is one of those.
Saudi Arabia is one of them.
Mm-hmm. Our telephone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. Foreign policy experts Gada Telhami and Art Sear are joining us in our studios in Chicago. And I'm Bruce Dumont. We're coming to you live from Stockholm, Sweden. 1-800-723-8289. More calls when we roll on in about 3 minutes.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of the Beyond the Beltway program from September 16, 2001, produced in Stockholm, Sweden. It was the first show following the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. This is Bruce Dumont.
From Stockholm, Sweden, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with our broadcast, Beyond the Beltway. Joining us back in our studio in Chicago, we have Art Sear, and he is a political science professor, the Clausen Professor of Political Science at Carthage College, that's in Kenosha, Wisconsin, author of the book After the Cold War, Europe and Asia. Professor of Political Science Gada Telhami also joins us. She teaches at Lake Forest College. She is a Palestinian American born in Jerusalem, and she has been a citizen and a resident of the United States for over 30 years. And also, for those of you who are listening to us on radio, we should remind you that in hour number two, we will be joined by Magnus Norell, and if you've lived in Europe, he has basically been on the television virtually almost nonstop for the last week, one of Europe's leading experts on terrorism, and we will be talking with him during the second hour of this broadcast. Let's go back to calls. Let's go to Martha, who's listening to us in Santa Monica on KOGO. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, Bruce. We miss you out here.
Well, I miss being back there, believe me.
We're going to try and get you back. Yeah, it's a shock. It's not really surprising in a way. And when this is all over, all the hullabaloo is all over, I hope we don't go back to business as usual. We accommodate people beyond sanity. Those people have been here. They have no right to be here. And they've been preparing for this maybe for as much as a year or more. And
Martha, let me stop you for just a second, okay? Because I want to pick up on something that you said. And before we went on the air, Art Sear was alluding to something of that nature. When he was talking about people in America living in dreamland. What did you mean by that, Art?
I think we've been so secure and so rich for so long that we took peace and prosperity for granted, especially peace. Carthage College, like any academic institution, the vast majority of our population are young people in their late teens and early and mid-20s. It's one thing that the main thing that makes it a wonderful place. And the state of the reaction of shock and surprise among these young people has been quite striking. We had a colloquium, which I moderated with three other faculty to discuss the matter with students, and the sense of the world turned upside down was quite apparent.
Have we go ahead, Martha.
Yeah. Well, I'll get off, but I just want to say this. No one is more accommodating than United States citizens. We're so giving. We mm-hmm. give of ourselves, even at great sacrifice. But now we've given thousands of human lives, which should never have happened. Our borders leak like a sieve. We look the other way, and these people just go their own way. They get
Let's talk about that. Gada Tilhami, leak like a sieve. You're an American citizen. You must be concerned about people sneaking into this country for no good.
I agree, but I don't know how they do this.
About military troops? You know, people used to say when Patrick Buchanan said, you know, put up the barbed wire fences, send the troops, to the border, they laughed at him. They thought he was ridiculous. Do we have to go to that?
We probably do. We probably have to at least watch our Canadian border. But let me tell you, when I travel overseas...
And our Mexican border. Because, we speak so much on this program. The last 5 or 6 weeks, we've done so much about the illegal immigration into the United States from Mexico. At this very moment, how do we know that would-be terrorists are not sneaking into the United States right now?
What?
Not everyone sneaking into the country is a Mexican.
I agree, but watch the immigration regulations. That's very important. Watch people who come on irregular visas or special visas. When I travel to Europe, by the way, I get always stopped coming back to the U.S. because my passport states my place of birth and my country of origin. Mm. So I do get checked over and over and over again. I don't think there's any problem with that, and I'm willing to accept that. But you see, how come this doesn't apply to other people? There are many ways of doing this. But I think, Bruce, sooner or later, we have also to open our file on our policy towards the Middle East and towards that part of the world, which has really been kind of giving us grief. We really have to have a reassessment of our foreign policy.
Well, this may not be the time to do that, however.
Well, we have to, because a military strike is not going to do it alone. You need a mix. You may need a military strike, you may need a reassessment of our foreign policy, and you need to really think seriously about our immigration regulations.
Art, would a reassessment of our policy in the Middle East at this time be viewed as weakness worldwide?
I don't think we need to reassess our policy in the Middle East, except insofar as we have to make adjustments to hold together this Middle Eastern coalition. I do think that the administration should be more assertive in the Middle East regarding Israel and the Palestinians, and have felt that's from the beginning of the Bush administration, but that is separate from this concern about terrorism, as is really concern about immigration. The discussion there is masses of undocumented workers coming into the U.S. Very few people carried off these horrendous atrocities, these despicable acts. And the problem is, in an age of advanced technology, very few lunatics can wreak tremendous destruction.
So the issue is, if we're talking about this havoc, we're talking about 18 people at the moment. 18 people did this.
With a big support staff, obviously.
With a big support staff and money. And I want to talk about money in hour number two and the funding of worldwide terrorism. However, the reality is, it isn't just people that are sneaking in this country from Mexico that may want to mow some guy's lawn in San Bernardino that we have to worry about. Because certainly those enemies of the United States are those evildoers, as President Bush spoke about today. Mm-hmm. They certainly know we have a sieve in Mexico, and we also obviously have a sieve in Canada, mm-hmm. and we must do something about it. It is not just right-wing rhetoric that demands that our borders be safe. This country has an obligation to its people to protect its borders. A nation that cannot protect its borders obviously cannot protect its people. And we've got to do something about it, and it just can't be some wacko right-winger talking about it.
I've been impressed at how quickly these people have been picked up, which not only speaks well of FBI and law enforcement, but also implies that if we're more assertive, without violating basic civil rights, but if we're more assertive and vigilant and active in looking for suspicious people, people with criminal records, and monitoring them,
We got to go to another call. Let's go to John in Lynchburg, Virginia. You're on Beyond the Beltway, coast to coast. John, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Speak up, please.
If you look at this country and you look at our leaders when they're on TV, you will notice that they are mostly white people, white males, Christians. This is a Christian country. It's founded by Christian people. The time has come for us as Christians to hold hands and realize that there are people in this world that don't like us.
Gee, you know, I thought Colin Powell was an African-American, and Condoleezza Rice, I thought she was black as well. I must be missing something here. We've had a large number of Jewish people in senior foreign policy slots, sir, in the last 10 years.
You're missing the fact that 5,000 people died because people like you turned their eyes away.
I think that kind of hate talk. Sorry, that kind of hate language doesn't do anyone any good. It doesn't help policy, and it doesn't help the ethical standard of this country.
Is there something to this caller's point, however? God, I'll let you respond to it. Is there a fear, a great fear here, that those who represent Osama bin Laden are going to try to turn this into an Islam-Christian showdown?
Well, that's where we need to be very much in control of our emotions in this country. We cannot turn this into a battle against American Muslims. Because, you know, the statement that came out of the United Nations Racism Conference in Durban condemned the crime of Islamophobia. We have now a new name called Islamophobia. This country needs all the people in it. Every American has an ethnic background. His parents or grandparents came from an ethnic background. We can't say because Osama bin Laden is Muslim that all Muslims are evil. We cannot do this unless if we're willing, of course, to blame Timothy McVeigh on Christians. Timothy McVeigh was a Gulf War veteran. He was a Christian. And look what he did.
I think what you may have to do at this particular point, though, is as an Arab American, one thing that you may have to do, and many of your colleagues will have to do it, and many of your colleagues already are doing it. And when I mean colleagues, I mean your colleagues within the Islamic community in the United States. They must be the loudest voices in condemning this.
They
must not go overboard in talking about their civil rights if they're inconvenienced at a border or entering a plane in the United States. Because most people in this country, if they get on a plane tomorrow or the next time they get on a plane and they see an Arab in on that plane, they are going to be frightened.
I think, Bruce, I don't agree with you totally. I think they have been condemning the attack loudly. It's an attack on our country, on me, on the future of my children. My children are Americans. We understand that fully. But at the same time, we're not going to sit silently and watch our civil rights being stripped away. Because that's not only bad for us. That's bad for every minority in this country. We cannot compromise on this issue.
On line 10, let's go to Mike in Seattle listening to us on KVI. Good evening. You're on the air.
Boy, I feel embarrassed to follow the Klansmen there, but I'll tell you, I'm an American. I'm a former service member. I flew jets. More than happy to defend my country. I have several relatives that are down there at the Trade Center. I'm a New Yorker, and they're digging through the rubble right now looking for their friends. Whole fire companies have been wiped out down there, and I'm very embedded in the New York Fire Department.
Mike, let me stop you for a moment. We do have to go to a break here. I'm going to put you on hold because I want you to continue with your conversation, and we will give you an opportunity to do that. I'm Bruce Dumont, live from Stockholm, Sweden. Our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border, taking America's political pulse tonight on American Resolve and American military retaliation for the terrorist attack on America last week.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of the Beyond the Beltway program from September 16th, 2001. Produced in Stockholm, Sweden, it was the first broadcast following the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. I'm Bruce Dumont.
From Worcester, Mass. To Greensboro, South Carolina, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029, our broadcast this evening. Coming to you from both Chicago and also I am live in Stockholm, Sweden, for Radio Sweden, which is right next door to the American Embassy. And a few days ago, after the tragedy in New York and Washington, I went over there to pay my respects to those that had lost their lives. And there was a very moving monument from the people of Sweden who came with candles and flowers and American flags and in the very wet streets. It was at night when I was there. It was a most moving experience, paying tribute to those that gave their lives. And the following day, when I returned to talk to a number of Swedes who were showing up there, offering their condolences to me as an American and paying their tribute to those that lost their lives, there was so much respect for the United States. And there was some fear for what our response might be, but they understood that we did have to respond. And both young and old that we spoke with were both moved and wanted to express their condolence and their loss to those throughout the country. We are now going back to line 10. Mike is on Seattle, KBI in Seattle. And Mike, you were mentioning that you have close friends and associates that are working in New York City, and you were going to continue with your point.
Yeah, my I have an uncle in a fire company back there. He's retired. He lost five guys in the engine company 84. That's 155th in Amsterdam. So five of the guys are dead out of his company. Well, yeah, missing. Yeah. Hey, what I want to talk about is the professor's comment about revisiting American foreign policy with Israel. We need to revisit this. She's actually right. This thing's not going away, and I find it very suspicious that this event has occurred in the manner it did. I support Israel. I have a Jewish father, Christian mother. I've been to Israel with the military before, even gave my dad a piece of masada. I think that she's right. This is a rub, and we have committed, blindly committed, to the Israeli cause. And I find it very suspicious, especially about finding out that there were pieces of human intelligence provided by Israeli intelligence to us that the attack occurred. And I find that this is actually probably a disaster to the Palestinians. I think the Palestinians are making a lot of headway. Americans are getting tired of the fight that's going on over there. And they're being drawn in more closely to the Israeli cause. I've heard talk show hosts on this very station saying, we don't need to just hit bin Laden. We need to hit all terrorists. Well, that's great. So now we're fighting Israel's fight for them. We've got a huge fight here. We are going to strike back, and we're going to kill this guy. I'm an advocate of using any force necessary, starting with cutting off his economic potential. Mm-hmm. But we need to revisit our foreign policy with respect to the Palestinian-Israeli position.
Art Sear, your response to the assessment.
Well, I'm not sure I follow the argument completely. I think that in practical terms we're going to be working more closely with Israel on with LL on airline security, if nothing else. We have not blindly followed Israel, I don't believe, for many years. The first Bush administration, and for that matter the Reagan administration, we're increasingly distant from Israel. My complaint is that we've been quite aloof. I think we have to be engaged. I don't think we should be engaged in going down the line for Israel, and I don't think this Bush administration will do so.
And I hope they don't. One quick point here.
Yes, sir.
If we're relying on Israeli intelligence, we should not, and America should not, forget the attack on the USS Liberty by Israeli forces. This is an attempt by Israel to prevent intelligence gathering by the United States at a point they felt critical.
In 1967,
they were willing,
right?
When convenient, to take out our intelligence sources. We should be very skeptical.
That was in 1967, okay. I believe, right?
It's still the same country.
Yeah, Bruce,
we've got to move on, but got to go ahead, make a point.
Yeah, the point is we do need to revisit the Arab-Israeli conflict simply because our neglect of Palestinian legitimate rights has always inflamed Islamic and Arab public opinion. This is not to imply in no way that this attack on the World Trade Center had anything to do with Palestinians. We understand that. And obviously, Mr. bin Laden isn't really that concerned about Palestinians or the Palestinian issue.
No, that's right.
Let's go to Richard.
He has his own agenda.
Richard in Virginia, listening to us on a car phone. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Okay, my comment was that a few months ago, I believe I read an article in the paper about Gaddafi making a statement about a concerted Arab effort about making a new terrorist threat against the United States with mass destruction or whatever. You might want to look at it as a nexus search or whatever, but vague in my mind. The point I'm trying to make in it is if there is a further connection in many other countries, would we have a righteous cause in going after every one of them, Iraq, Iran, etc.?
Art?
Two points. I've been impressed, again, that Gaddafi has made very specific sympathetic statements about the United States. He's condemned terrorism, he's condemned this act, and he's implied he'd support any coalition effort. I do believe he's engaged in his own program of development of weapons of mass destruction. He's one of four rogue states identified by our government. In 1986, we did bomb Libya. Clearly, our intention was to kill him. We didn't kill him. We did kill his three-year-old daughter. Since that time, he's been generally subdued and very cautious about what he said. I think he remains a very dangerous man and has been responsible for some of the most dangerous terrorist development that our government has faced. In this case, we counted him rather effectively.
Can we win? Can we win this war without ground troops somewhere in the Middle East?
No.
You've got to tell
how. Can I answer
no.
this? Well,
yes,
obviously,
30 seconds.
Obviously, any attack on Afghanistan will need ground troops because cruise missiles isn't going to do the job. So we have to really accept this possibility.
Art, 15 seconds to you.
Yes, we have to go in on the ground. We have to go in with special teams. We can occupy Afghanistan, but that would be a mistake. Afghanistan has never been conquered, not by the Soviets and not by the British in the 19th century. It's a tremendous warrior culture and very, very difficult terrain.
And with those closing words from Art Sear, we conclude the rebroadcast of the first hour of Beyond the Beltway from September 16, 2001. Our first broadcast following the attack on American soil that rocked this country and was remembered today in ceremonies in New York, Washington, and Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Let us never forget what happened 10 years ago today, and let us never let our defenses down again. We must always remember and be on alert against those who would do us harm. Our political debates will go on about the wisdom of our actions following the attacks, but in debating the rightness or wrongness of our actions, let us not forget the 5 million men and women who stepped up following September 11th and donned a uniform to protect this nation. Over 6,200 of them have died in Afghanistan and Iraq. They remind us that the price of freedom is costly. Let us remember their families tonight in this day of remembrance, as well as those victims of 9/11. From Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night.